Hi. Thank you very much for coming. So our panel is actually called Content and Coding Are Not Commodities, and the grand sort of scheme of it is trying to help like people basically who are geeks and people who are, I guess, sort of the writers, creators, mutually understand each other, because this is something that's come up for all of us over time. And I'm just going to do a quick run through of everyone who's on the panel. My name is Jennifer Lee. I am one of the organizers of a group called Hacks and Hackers. I'm a writer, journalist, worked at the New York Times for a long time, and throw parties, I think, basically, is what I do now. And I'm working on another book. But I have a lot of familiarity also with technology in Silicon Valley. Next to me is Andre Shankman, who was one of my colleagues at the New York Times and is now at the Huffington Post. And Raju Narasetty, who very recently just switched back to the Wall Street Journal, but before that was at the Washington Post as a also basically both jobs overseeing a lot of the digital sort of management and content. And the official name actually now, your title is Deputy Managing Editor?
Of the paper.
Of the paper.
Managing editor
of a lot of the Wall Street Journal and Dow Jones properties. And last but not least is Ben Balter, who is, we like to say, is all the chief technology officer of Hacks and Hackers, and also works at the White House under the federal CIO. So just to sort of give you guys a sense, what we have found as programmers and journalists sort of have come together to collaborate is that there's almost this cultural clash. And as we see the problem, coders, and we use that sort of as a word sort of for developers and engineers, see content as stuff and code as the art, whereas the creators, like the journalists, see the code as stuff and the content as art. And you see sort of evidence of this cultural clash in many different places, including this sign, which hangs on the sixth floor of a major technology company, and which is trying to move into sort of more of the content space. And Andre actually can kind of speak to it a little bit more. So one of the things is...
So when Jenny told me about her idea for this panel, this was the first thing that came to mind. And this is... in a building in New York at a certain tech company that's trying really hard to become a media company. And to me, this kind of illustrated what she was talking about perfectly, in that this idea that pieces of content are this thing that you can just, you know, enumerate. And just the idea of putting together a sign that said 27 million pieces of content are shared each day, especially after being at the New York Times, where people never use words like content or would never even talk about these things in terms of counting them, I thought was really funny. And then there's an explainer at the bottom of the sign that says, what is content, right? This is for the engineers to understand what we're talking about. And it says, content includes things like published articles, professional videos, and photos. It doesn't include home movies or party pics.
And on the other side, there's also... So journalists understanding technologists, and this is also from Andre, which I thought was like kind of amusing.
So this was what I thought was a really exciting blog post from one of my favorite political bloggers about his newspaper's ambitions to do more interesting stuff with technology. And you know, I think he gets it. He's a young guy. He understands technology. He captures it perfectly, where he asks, you know, are you a politics obsessed software developer, a journalism-loving mobile interface genius? The Washington Post wants you. And in his description about it, he talks about, you know, we want smart, talented tech types who are interested in journalism. And then when you click through to the actual job descriptions, you get something like this. You will collaborate with IT staff and clients to establish service level and operating level agreements that set measurable IT service and systems performance expectations and regularly track and audit performance and service levels against these agreements. And so to me, that was the converse of the problem, the issue of something's going on in this media company where somebody's not understanding what's really going on with developers and technology.
And Raju, I think, did this go up while you were there?
Yes, the media company is the Washington Post. Just to take names.
Sorry.
And a whole bunch of my colleagues from the Post, ex-colleagues from the Post are here. It reflects a larger issue that we have, which is that I think some of you sat in on Dan and Emily's panel earlier, heard him talk a little bit about this idea that up until recently, journalism was being done to put on the web, and it's only recently that we are talking about doing journalism or creating an experience for readers and audiences that is off the web. And the more we do that now, the importance of like journalists and those who call developers and coders to collaborate has really really taken off. And this ad is a good example of that, right? That the IT department wants certain base skills for developers, you know, Django, Python, and all that. So they write it in that way. What they then don't necessarily do is think about what are we going to do with these kind of technical underpinnings in creating experiences. And that's what Ezra Kine was talking about. So you can see the gap in thinking about the same resource in a very different way, depending on who's kind of looking at hiring them and who's kind of looking at kind of managing them.
Yeah. If you want to see them, you can. Okay, that's good. So I've thought about this problem a lot, and I actually think that, or we do, I collectively think that actually people who work in technology and people who work creatively in being journalists and stuff actually have a lot more in common than they expect. And if you kind of think about it, the mindset you have to understand the other side is to understand that they are actually mostly like you, right? And that both sides want to work with smart people on interesting problems that have impact. And if you understand that about coders, or if you as a coder, if you understand that about people who are writing or making contents, you are probably about halfway there. And that's actually one of the most important kind of concepts that we, as you know, where I do in terms of hackers want to push out there. And as a panel, it's one of the main points that we would want to kind of push out there, to understand that in order to motivate someone, you have to basically figure out, will they think they're working with smart people on interesting problems that will impact on the world, whether or not it's an article or an investigative project, or you're creating some kind of new kind of standards or sort of frameworks, is it something that will go out and have impact? So we kind of have a little, you know, manifesto in terms of giving advice on both sides, how to make this sort of collaborative process smoother. So one of the first kind of points is to understand that coders and creators are not short order chefs in a way. They're not necessarily people who should be given just instructions. And just as an example of something that I get, you know, not infrequently, it's someone who has a great idea for a journalism startup, and they email us asking us for a developer. So, you know, I got this email a couple weeks ago from someone who once worked at a major journalism company, and also previously at a tech company. And basically he said, you know, as leaders of the Hacks and Hackers group, I figured you might be able to help me track down a developer with a bit of time to do a fun journalism project this month. And basically, you know, he gave me a very, very specific, I'm kind of blocking out some of the stuff, but basically he gave me a very, very specific thing that he needed done. You know, he needs a front-end developer to do this thing, and it requires HTML and JavaScript, and it involves like connecting a front-end blank to a, you know, back-end blank using API calls. And, you know, basically it'll take about one person a week of time, and, you know, this should be done before the end of February. And so far, I actually just had lunch with him. He has not found anyone yet. And to a certain extent, in meeting with him, I can kind of understand why. So one of the first points that we want to make is that don't just give orders, and I think Ben can probably speak a little bit to this. This is his stuff, yeah.
So the slide a couple slides ago used the phrase short order chef. If you walk into a McDonald's or something, you say, I want a cheeseburger, no pickles. If you hire a plumber, you'll say, I need, you know, a faucet there, I need a shower here. But you never go up to an attorney and say, I need a contract for a fee simple absolute subject condition precedent, right? You go up to them and say, I have a problem. Here's the problem that I am facing. Let's find a solution together, and let's see if we can both come to a solution. And so what you do there is, the common vocabulary is you're talking in terms of a problem. You come to them and say, here is my problem, and how can we both, you know, both take ownership of this problem and both come to a solution together and build something even better than if one of us or the other of us just attacked this problem alone.
Yeah. So at the White House, do you see, I mean, what are sort of, this, some of the situations that you've seen working where you work, and just tell us a little bit actually about where what you end up doing, both at the FCC and then now also at the White House.
Right. So it's a lot of times someone will walk in and they'll say, okay, we have this problem and we need a CMS. We need Drupal. We need SharePoint. And it's they're coming to the table already assuming the solution and just asking me or asking the developers just to implement that solution. There's no opportunity for creativity. There's no opportunity for leeway. And most importantly, there's no opportunity for me to shed my expertise. Maybe I can see that problem in a different light and say, actually, I think this solution might be a little bit better for that, or maybe this solution might be a little bit better for that. And there's several circumstances where oftentimes the subject matter experts, the journalist, whatever they might be, will come to the table with a solution and then work backwards and then eventually tell me what the problem is so I can start tackling it.
So one of the things that we would that is good is when you start together at the beginning defining what the problem is, and then you work forward both from like the quote unquote content side and then the coding side to figure out, well, what is a problem that we're trying to solve? And you know, for example, you might go up and say we want a political blog or an election blog, but really what the original problem that you're trying to solve is we want sort of a place where people can get, you know, pretty real-time updates on what's happening sort of in this election cycle. The solution for that might be a political blog. It might be something else. But to figure out on a base level what the users are trying to do, and both figure out from a technology perspective and from a content perspective, you know, what is the best thing that we can do to collaborate in order to you know, move forward. And one of the reasons for this is at that level, then you actually have a lot more emotional buy-in from both the people who are creative on a coding side and also on a content side. Because I would say, like, Ben, how often do you get, like, I'm looking for a technical co-founder kind of stuff?
Yeah, and I'm always like honored and like amazed when someone comes to me and like, I have an idea, help me, versus like, I have a solution, help me implement it. And it's really humbling, and it's really great because you can come in with this creativity and come in with this passion, and even if the technological solution is the same in the end, you approach it with such a different light and with such a different direction because it's your project, because your name is on it, because you're there at the inception stage, and you really, really take it and take the ball and run with it. To put it the other way for a second, imagine, for example, if I have built this really cool content management system or this really cool live stream, whatever it is, and I come to you, like Jenny, for example, and say, I need 50 man on the street interviews. Can you get me to them, like, you know, next week? How long do you think that'll take you? Right. If you turn the table the other way around, it just the system just doesn't make sense.
So the other thing that we're also trying to point out is that not all technology people have the same job, and not all, basically IT is not necessarily the same as engineering. And so oftentimes what developers find in the newsroom is they get sometimes mixed up with the IT help desk. And I think Andre has do you want to use that story? You don't want to use that story? Okay, we're not going to use the story of people basic. Or actually, no, you also have stories at the White House.
At a previous job, so we built a content management system for a government agency. And, you know, it was great. It had content. It had usernames, logins. And we had a help desk set up. They were trained to handle problems. Somehow, somebody found out where our office was and then spread that around the listserv. So, you know, we're doing user group testing. We're doing wireframes and knock on the door. Hey, I'm having trouble. Can someone help me reset my password? Or I can't get this link in. And the image not displaying properly. So we actually had a petition that we were jokingly circulating around to try to move our office, or at least like change the signage in our office so that people couldn't find us and just direct them towards the help desk. But it's definitely just because I sit behind a computer and you know, maybe drink Mountain Dew or have glasses or something, that doesn't mean that I know how to like clear your cookies or whatever that is, or that necessarily is what I should be doing at, you know, 3 p.m.
That's true.
And although if you do have a problem, clear your cookies and then restart your computer. That solves like 90% of the problems. And make sure it's plugged in.
So one of the things is we feel like, I think one of the tensions is we need new vocabulary words for these roles. And I see this struggle over and over again. When developers are brought into the newsroom, they have really interesting and weird titles, like interactive news editor. I think both Raju and Andre, who kind of work on this front, can kind of speak a little bit to it. Yeah.
It again goes back to needing to change some stereotypes, right? Especially among journalists, their idea of like
A developer is somebody who basically writes code, which is what they do, but that's not the only thing they do. And part of the problem I have seen, and I think we continue to see in newsrooms, is because of the titles that people who bring technical skills and coding skills have, there tends to be a stereotype about what they do, and they're not treated on par as reporters or editors or other, you know, higher level beings. And part of this panel is to kind of talk about the issues that we're all facing and say that maybe some of the things that need to change are these kind of four or five things. And I think one of the things that to throw out there, and it'll be interesting when we have time for a Q&A, is if there are suggestions on whether for changing the title, it might seem very symbolic, whether that would actually help kind of remove the internal stereotypes and silos that are existing right now.
Andre, do you have any thoughts? What's your title, actually, at this point? And what was your thinking of in getting to that title?
Oh, I'm the interactive news editor at the Huffington Post, and I just copied my boss's title from my previous job.
But it has been, we were trying to come up with a, I remember actually debating with him what his title should be. And it is actually really interesting, because one of the tensions is there are journalists that work mostly with code. I mean, that's kind of what ideally you want, but we are calling them like still programmers or developers or engineers. At Google, for example, the people, they call it engineering because that is primarily how they see themselves. But within the context of a newsroom, these words are very alien, right? And so you have this constant tension, because the Times and other newsrooms basically understand things in terms of editors. Like, are you a reporter or are you an editor? Or, like, if you're neither of those, what are you? You're some kind of weird, or a photographer. That one's also okay, right? So editors, you have metro editors, copy editors, photo editors, assistant managing editors, you know, a managing editor, it's executive editor. So everything is sort of mostly in that kind of role, or you're a reporter, right? And so it's this weird kind of creature, you know, these people, they do something in that corner, and they're neither really reporters, and they're not neither. Sometimes the word editor gets attached to them if there are people underneath them. Then they can be interactive news editors. But it is an open question. Like, we don't have a solution to this, but we're basically posing it as an open question. Like, and if anyone wants to kind of jump in comments later or questions, what these titles should be called would be great. In part because one of the things I do is Hacks Hackers just started a jobs like newsletter list, or I'm about to send out, after South By, the first compilation. And it's so interesting to see the struggle of what the title is when they send it to me. Like, in terms of, basically, they want someone who can code and do things that engage and inform, you know, communities or the world at large. But developer doesn't quite capture it, right? And it seems so generic. And so you know, if anyone has a suggestion or wants to sort of further that conversation, that would be great. So one of the important things is also to understand the creative mind of the coder. So the next part of sort of our panel is help both journalists understand how to motivate programmers, and also for programmers and people who are coming from the technical side, how to speak to basically people who create stuff. So, Ben, what gets you more excited than not when you're approached with a problem?
I love the challenge. I love the Rubik's Cube aspect to it, the crossword puzzle aspect to it. If you come to me and say, I've got this killer idea, I don't think it's possible, that'll motivate me so much more. So if you have a little kid and say, you can't have any cookies, what's the first thing they want to do? They're going to want to eat a cookie, right? So if you go to a developer and say, I got this killer idea, it's really a shame. It'd be great if we can do this. It's too bad the technology is just not there. That's a challenge. And I would love to jump up to that challenge and say, let me prove you wrong. Let me prove you how cool technology is and how, you know, I'm better than you or whatever it is that motivates me. But it's that challenge. It's that drive. It's that no one's ever done this before. This is impossible. I don't think this is possible. And then doing the impossible that, you know, it just, if you're a journalist, you want to do something that gets you credit in your field. You want to do something that's creative, that's pushing the envelope, gain the respect of your peers. And I think that's no different whether you're writing codes or you're writing words.
Right. And if you're coming from a technology side, you should sort of basically speak in a language that motivates writers and creators. And one of the, so I'm going to kind of speak a little bit about this. So one of the first things is just as a writer, we hate the term CMS because we don't think content is something that is to be, quote, managed. And there's actually a great quote from the Washington Post ombudsman about why it's not great, in part because it reduces the heart and soul of journalism, stories, photos, graphics, and news into generic, quote, content, something akin to the unidentifiable filling in a Twinkie, like, ick. And it's kind of interesting because I've always tried to struggle as a writer why things get abstracted to this term called content. And I think Ben can speak to, like, why you guys think of just content. It's like all content is like created the same. It's like that's, they think of it sometimes as a commodity.
Yeah. So if you think of the website for a second as a violin, right, no one would argue that a Stradivarius can't be art or a Stradivarius can't be beautiful. Likewise, no one would argue that, you know, a Beethoven sonata played on that same Stradivarius can't be beautiful. So coders approach to see the violin, or just as a violin manufacturer would see the violin as art, and a musician or violinist would see the music that it creates as art, you take that same logic and you apply it on the code level. So as a developer, if you come to me and say, I need a workflow to publish X kind of content, let's call it, you know, a blog post, right, I could solve that problem, but I know 6 months down the line, you're going to come to me and say, okay, I now need a workflow to also publish videos, or I also need a workflow to publish slideshows. And so rather than solving the same problem, the one problem seven times, it's a lot easier for me to solve seven problems one time. So in programming terms, we call that abstraction. You want to take this stack of logic. So if I have a website, I'm going to build up this giant box of logic, this giant stack of all these logical things. If it's a single page, if it's an index page, whatever it is, and I don't care about what the content is until the exact last minute. I put a little box in the middle of the page, the content box, and that's, when you think about it in computer terms, that's the only thing that the computer can't understand, right? It can understand what page you want, what you search for, but it can't understand the words that are actually on the page or the video that's actually on the page. And that's why we have metadata, that's why we have categories, that's why we have tagging. So as a developer, I need to build up this entire stack, and for me, that's elegant code. That's the Stradivarius, that if I can find an elegant solution that solves 10 problems rather than one.
It also addresses a couple of issues that keep coming up in newsrooms more and more. The first one is, I think neither journalists nor developers are necessarily thinking in terms of the audience or the reader experience. It's always about, you know, I'll build this really cool widget, or my writing and my data is going to kind of, you know, make this a great story. But at the end of the day, all the major papers in the U.S. had really great Oscar packages, right? Because that's what we do on Oscar night. The reason why somebody would come back to the New York Times or to the Journal or the Washington Post or any other paper is if the experience of that was very different and very compelling. So I think it's important to push on these projects to kind of think in terms of experiences rather than what each one is bringing to the table. The second issue, and this is a really chronic problem, and again, don't really have solutions but want to raise it, is this idea of replicability. I mean, you talked about not wanting to build something just for one story or one video, but want to do something that can be used over and over again, which in an environment like this where resources are pretty tight is the ideal solution. The one downside and the one thing that none of us have really been able to figure out is the journalist, the reporter, and the editor, and the photographer, they move on after the story. The experience is built, it survives on your website. They expect the developer to kind of maintain it and keep it up if somebody comes a year later for it to be functioning. But that's not what the developer is thinking as well, because they're thinking, I built it, it's working, and then I need to move on to the next thing. But at the end of the day, if somebody comes back to it, it's a pretty horrible experience. Code is broken, the data is old. So we have to either learn to kind of kill some of these big projects, which is a really hard thing to do in newsrooms where they think everything stays forever, or we have to figure out who owns it and how are we going to kind of keep it going. Some newsrooms have done a good job with replicability, but most of us haven't. We build really fun things, aim for the Pulitzer, we get it or not, and then we move on to the next big project, but the thing stays and it can be used, and it's usually a pretty horrible experience. So it's important to kind of think of that at the beginning of a project, saying, what happens to this 6 months from now or 3 months from now when we're all done? Does it have a shelf life? Will we kill it? Will we put a date on it and say, after this, it'll just stay in an archive, not in a kind of a database that you can use? So these are important things to think at the beginning of the project rather than at the end of the project.
So another point that I like to make, one of the reasons I actually came to understandings of this creative conflict is I spent a lot of time in Silicon Valley. And it was actually a conversation in one particular company. There's a company called Quora, which I respect and sort of admire a lot. And they're basically a big question and answer site on the interwebs. And they have the two founders were former and very early Facebook employees. And so they see – it's really interesting seeing their world through the eyes of product engineering. So they have – you know, at a certain point, I think earlier – at the end of last year, they maybe had like 31 employees, of which 27 were product and engineering. And so it was really fascinating talking to them, because one of the things that they really need is sort of high value creative content. They need really high quality writing, and they were trying to figure out how to motivate people to become really kind of to contribute. And the things that do really well there are certain kind of answers just do really really well. And in terms of talking to them, what I realized is from an engineering and technology perspective, like content is all about low touch and scale, right? That's what gets them really excited. So you look at YouTube, you look at Twitter. When they often think about how are we doing? The metrics that you hear them measure in is, you know, the minutes of the minutes of video that are uploaded every hour, you know, for the rest of, you know, every day, and or the number of tweets that are sort of basically like created every day. And it's interesting because from a media perspective, almost every media perspective, it's not about low touch and scale. It's actually about high touch. And then where you get your scale is from quality and not just quantity. And so, you know, like if we think about it, both like Hunger Games and Harry Potter and the other sorts of hits come because they resonate with people and then they kind of have an incredible kind of climb. And what I kind of wanted to emphasize to sort of the founders is that to a certain extent it's very much about creating relationships and finding the very, very high level of content, because a good answer is worth like, you know, at least 10x or 100x of any answer generically, right? So all kind of writing is not created equal. And so you can actually see some of the mindset of a tech company moving to a media company in something like YouTube, which in the last, I think in October, they announced basically a $100 million investment in creating higher value content, where they basically created a bunch of partnerships with people to create videos that were not just sort of cat videos or like, you know, kid videos, because they suddenly saw the value of that. And that's a very, very high touch kind of experience. And they don't necessarily it's interesting watching them trying to manage those relationships, because they're not necessarily designed to have sort of high touch relationships where you have to work with creative people a lot. So one of the things that we also want to talk about is sort of some of the very practical solutions and practical things that you can do in an organization to address some of these cultural kind of chasms. And one of them is actually very simple, which is where you sit matters both geographically and organizationally. And Raju, I think you've worked with this a lot, haven't you?
You guys can keep me honest if I'm making stuff up. I think I'll give you the Washington Post example. About 3 years ago, we had 6 developers in the newsroom that were out of the newsroom funded by us. And then the IT department had a few of them as well. But it was clear that over the next couple of years, as all our media companies face economic pressures, that we would not be able to really ramp up the newsroom part of the developers, meaning that I wouldn't go from 6 to 20 of them because I knew that funding wasn't going to be available. So the thing to do was to kind of at that time, and which is what we did fairly successfully, I think, is to give them back to the IT department, say, take my slots, take my people, but we'll expect you to kind of serve the newsroom. 3 years later, I think it has happened or happening, probably about 18 or 20 developers are going to be more than that, are going to be embedded in the newsroom and be part of a newsroom team that kind of creates these experiences working with journalists. The reason this happened was twofold. One is that the IT departments all over, especially in old media companies, are having a heck of a time trying to find really good developers, because if they have a choice, they want to work for Google and all these interesting companies. They don't want to come and work for the IT department of the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal or anybody else. But putting them in the newsroom gives us a very interesting calling card for filling these jobs, because a lot of, there are a group of developers who really still want to work with content and want to work with big brands and want to work with journalists. And even though their paychecks may still be coming out of the IT department, having them physically located in the newsroom and be working with newsroom managers on newsroom projects makes the hiring bit a lot easier for your CIO or CTO. So I think they see some rationale in kind of doing that. And the second thing is, most newsrooms tend not to kind of use architecture very well. And by that I mean they don't think about the value of where people sit and how collaborative that can be. Again, at the Post, when we redid the newsroom and we combined the print and online operations, we very deliberately put the kind of the main editing hub in the middle of the newsroom, right in front of the editor's office, to give it kind of both the symbolic and real value. And I think very similar things can be done where you put your developers to both give them kind of the sense of being part of the main news operation and also to kind of do more collaborative efforts. It's not easy because it's tough to kind of move people around in a newsroom. The reporters and their editors usually are at the top of the hierarchy. It's hard to get them to kind of move out to the periphery to create the space. But I think it's worth thinking about doing that because the payoffs are pretty high. We have found that when developers sit in like different floors, the challenge is a lot harder to get things done in a collaborative way because they're constantly being reinforced that they're in the IT department, they're not in the news floor. So it's important to push for that and try to create some physical space where that collaboration can happen. And organizationally, again, these embedded developers at the Washington Post, their paychecks are still going to come out of the IT department. They're going to be in the IT department's headcount. But the fact that in organizationally they see themselves as being in the newsroom, I think kind of creates a lot more interest and value and ability to hire them and get some really good folks to come to the newsroom as well.
How did you switch the job description? Did you see actually a flip when you started talking about the jobs in a different way in the applicant pool?
As you can tell from the earlier example of the job posting versus what the job is going to do, the switching hasn't particularly happened. But few little things, I think Sarah, and Justin here were involved in kind of rewriting the job postings. We asked them to give us their postings and say, can we rewrite them in a way that makes sense for the kind of people we are looking for, leaving all the technical qualifications in there, but not making them kind of the priority. And that was somewhat successful. Where you post the jobs makes a big difference as well. Telling them to go look at a place like Mashable Jobs or even Craigslist, which the IT department doesn't necessarily think of, made a difference as well. Involving the newsroom in interviewing people made a huge difference because then you get kind of the right set of people and they're interviewing. They're not coming in and meeting kind of a couple of engineers and project managers. They're actually then talking to the editors. In a couple of instances, I think, again, at the Post, we've had them meet the top two editors in the newsroom. It gives a sense of how important you will be when you come in with your skills. So little things have made a bit of a difference. I'm not saying they've solved all the issues. We have a great pipeline into newsrooms of people who can code. That's still going to be a challenge, but it's helped.
Do you think the top of the newsrooms now understand how important these people are? Are you seeing... I know you're at the top of your newsroom also, but are you seeing that kind of acknowledgement sort of trickle up?
I think the top of most newsrooms love something that's created and then engages a lot of readers. They don't necessarily pay attention to the process that makes that happen. It's getting there. The top of the newsroom has a lot of things to worry about these days, especially budget cuts and staffing. So to have them think in terms of like, do I have the right mix of developers? It's going to be a challenge anyway. But I think everybody is becoming more aware of the idea that they're going to win on the web through a great experience, and the great experience will only happen if you marry a great journalist with a great developer.
Sure. Andre, how, like, both being in a much more traditional newsroom and then sort of a more web-native newsroom, how have you seen sort of the organizational and geographic kind of situations matter? And you made a jump about 6 months ago?
That's right. You know, I joined the Times too late to get to see what everybody said was a really big transition between the everybody who worked for the website being physically separate from the newsroom. By the time I got there, there was already a group of developers that were sitting in the newsroom, and people who worked on multimedia projects and kind of a wide range of web-only projects. The move to HuffPost, I guess, was even more radical in that there, everybody who, in part because it's a smaller operation, but everybody who works on technology sits in the same room as all the reporters and editors. So it's not just the kind of newsroom developers who are working on real kind of like journalism-focused projects, but also our, you know, head system administrator and the guy who, you know, worries about, you know, caching for our site and these kind of super technical things sits in the same physical space. And I think even having those guys kind of like closer creates a culture where there does seem to be a lot more kind of like collaboration and integration, even among these things that you might think aren't needed. Like it seems unnecessary to have a politics editor and a system administrator and a DBA sitting kind of close to each other. But there's something that I think Riju described in terms of the way that people see their role and kind of see their function in the newsroom that seems to be a good thing.
And it's I actually was sort of at the time when you saw the transition. So at a certain point, with like many institutions, the web operation of web newsroom was sort of physically separated. So in the Times, it was actually in a separate building. And I remember at the Washington Post, not only was it in a separate building, it was in a separate state, if I remember. It was like the Washington Post was in Washington, D.C., and if I remember, the web newsroom was over in Roslyn.
Yeah.
And that actually was, to a certain extent, an interesting choice at the time, because what I understand is part of it was they wanted it to grow up separately under the shadow and sort of traditional structure of the newspaper, so it would have a sort of more fresh and dynamic culture. And now it's interesting to see everything sort of like integrate. And I would say it's been more smooth than not. I think from just observing as a as sort of a former, you know, a print journalist who also had to, I also worked on City Room, which is the New York Times Metro blog, and now you know, as sort of mostly consumer of those things. So one of the other things is sort of to acknowledge contribution. And I think Raju, you've sort of seen this evolve at the Washington Post as well, in sort of giving credit where credit is due.
Yeah, I mean, the Post spent a couple of years doing a really important and significant kind of project called Top Secret America, which kind of tracked all the post 9/11 spread of secrecy and infrastructure. From the very beginning of the project, there were, there were developers and there were graphics teams and there were like kind of really smart digital folks involved who kind of were figuring out what the experience would be. And when it was interesting, the night before the story ran in print, they were running a box of credits, and the credit was only like a photographer and a couple of other editors who had worked on. And I happened to be in the newsroom that evening, and I brought up the idea that how come we haven't credited all the other people who've been building all these databases? And they said, well, we've never ever done that at the Post before. It's always the photographers and the reporter and not even the lead editor is mentioned. And that would have been a tremendous disservice to the team that worked nearly 2 years if their names were not seen as part of this project that they've spent their life on, because they thought of themselves as kind of creating this wonderful experience. And I think it makes a huge difference. A lot of newsrooms have kind of gotten to the point where you see an interactive graphic and there'll be under it kind of in very 6-point the names of the people who have worked on it. But it's still kind of the mentality is that the reporter who creates the original content should get kind of the byline, and the photographers, because of legal reasons, have always gotten credit. It's important to push really hard to kind of make sure that the folks who have done the graphics and the kind of created the experience also get credited for that project, because it's the sum of all their work. That's what the readers are focused on. And it, again, creates a lot of buy-in in terms of the people who have worked on it, which is not something that's automatic in big newsrooms, and it's worth kind of pushing pretty hard to kind of get them to do that.
That's true. And so one of the things that is helpful, both from from a development's perspective and from the journalism perspective, is to think, like, what kind of problem are we solving for the user? And I think sometimes, both from a journalism and from a programming thing, that often gets dropped. But in terms of creating a collaboration, that is actually one of the more interesting sort of perspectives to think through. And I know, Raju, you've had kind of thoughts along those lines.
It feels like Jenny is picking on me.
Sorry. It was like weighted, like, you know, front and back, you know, Ben and then back.
Yeah, again, I we've been using, it's interesting that even on this panel, we've been using the term problem. Well, oftentimes a good piece of journalism is not really a collaboration between a reporter and a developer is not a problem-solving exercise per se. I would actually rephrase that to say that it's more about what is the experience we are trying to build for the reader or for the audience based on this content and how it's going to play on the web. And I think that's something that most newsrooms still don't start off by saying, what is the end user, end reader experience with this piece of content and with this piece of code? It's important to very formally kind of push that, I think, increasingly, because end of the day, we are only going to have loyalty, we're only going to bring readers back, we're only going to win this battle if we create that great experience. But most journalists and most developers don't necessarily start off thinking in that sense. It's more about, you know, writing this really powerful piece of software that can do X or Y, or kind of having really great kind of reporting anecdotes or really great kind of gotcha kind of things. But how does this come together, and what is the consumption of this, and what does that mean, is a good question to ask very formally up front, because I think that's what will get them to collaborate more. And it is the same idea of like solving a problem, but I wouldn't even phrase it as a problem, because oftentimes it's the experience that you're trying to build. The larger point very quickly is that most projects don't kind of define what would success be for this project. And that's not in terms of winning a prize, which is kind of what the typical journalist would think of, or making sure that kind of a widget, let's say, that you've built actually functions, but to kind of say, how do you define success in terms of, again, readers? Are we talking about engagement? Are we talking about page views? Are we talking about time spent? It's great to kind of, when these collaborative processes begin, to ask that question and say, let's define that, let's set some goals for what that would be. And obviously that means that we have to share the data and the metrics later on. But to just ask that question is something that doesn't happen. A lot of things get built, and then you ask, you know, wish we had done this because the users can't do X or Y with it.
Ben, can you talk about thinking about things from a user perspective from a developer standpoint?
Yeah, so from a developer standpoint, if you come at me and say, you know, we need a second source for this, or you start using journalism lingo, my eyes are going to glaze over just as quickly if I come to you and say, oh, well, the problem was we needed to typecast the data coming back from MySQL as a string. Right, but if we take the common goal of creating a very rich experience for the user, and you tell me, oh, well, the problem is the number's kind of hard to read because there's no thousand separator, I can understand that as a developer and say, okay, I need to typecast the data coming back from the MySQL database as a string. And as a journalist, you can say, we just need a comma there. Right? So you think about it in terms of features, you think about it in terms of functionality, and that's kind of the common language that we can both share. If you think about it in terms, we both speak different language, that's the overlap. With the actual feature. So talk in terms of buttons, in terms of colors, in terms of sizes, in terms of tangible touch and feel. And ideally, if you can do that if you're sitting together and you actually can sit down next to the developer and say, actually, can we make that button 2 pixels wider or make it a little bit bigger? I can do that, and it's a lot easier than if we talk about, well, we kind of need an opportunity here for people to submit stuff, and it's talk tangibly and talk in terms of what the user does and use lots of verbs, and that's what I as a developer can implement.
And I will actually say one of the biggest job demands I've seen is sort of people who think in terms of a user experience, user interface, or UX, UI jobs within a newsroom context. Like, those people are so valuable that when I see them, I usually pass their resumes around to, you know, at least 3 or 4 job openings that are sort of out there. So one of the things, you know, going forward is to for both sides, you know, to think, to understand both each other, and then sort of also, I guess, think in terms of what's the end, I hate this term, but end user experience in terms of the journalism. So we're free to open up the table, everything up for questions right now. Or does anyone have any sort of final comments that you'd like to make?
No, I just find it kind of a little bit ironical. I think parents used to tell kids that if you don't go to college and get a degree, you'll end up in a factory making widgets. I'm like, boy, if I can find people making widgets of digital kind these days, I would hire them like 3 times over. So in some ways, I think what our expectations are of, you know, what needs to be done has changed, especially in the newsrooms. And that's the reason why this is such a problem that we're trying to address, because the more that happens, the more the widget makers and the guys who do traditional reporting and editing need to kind of collaborate. And the issues that we're talking about are going to be bigger issues as time goes on, unless we kind of work more collaboratively.
That's true. Are there any questions from the floor? Yes. Yes.
So whether people realize it or not, the problem that we're actually talking about is something that pervades industry across many, many, many different disciplines.
Mm-hmm. And definitely.
In the strongest language, it is basically the problem of contempt. And that contempt, familiarity used to breed contempt. Now it is distance and removal that breeds contempt. And the removal of one discipline from another is something that actually forces people to believe that whatever is happening back there, they don't have to care. And that, oh, that's just details. I don't care how many bubbles are in a bar of soap. Just do what I tell you. And that works across both disciplines, and it works across hierarchy, from executive to employee, from employee to executive, from one discipline to another. And this typically is now festered, especially in IT, because IT people generally have become so arcane and so hard to understand.
And we're picked on our whole life, too, as it is.
Exactly.
I can fit in a locker really well.
Yeah. What was really interesting was the same location idea and that pulling them together, and that the thing that I try to work with my teams and the people that I work with on is that it's not just one thing, it's 100 things. You need to do everything you can to constantly break down the barriers. Are there any other things that you have seen? Because that's a new one for me, is just doing more and more just co-location. Are there any other things that you have seen that really break down the barriers between the multiple roles and the multiple disciplines?
Well, one of the things that we like to do, I don't know what city you are based in, but one of the things that we're trying to do with Hacks Hackers, which is a group that started sort of on a whim, but has kind of grown to having dozens, maybe 20, between 20 or 40 chapters, depending on how you count, over 5 continents. But part of it is the role is to bring people together socially to a certain extent, so that you have that sort of fun sense of serendipity, and that you have like the person who can talk to each other when they're drinking a cup of coffee, not only in sort of a Hacks Hackers context, but also in the newsroom context, that, you know, there's like a 5 o'clock coffee hour, and that when people see each other much more as like people and rather than just someone who has a functional role, that gives them the opportunity to sort of both ask something less formally, right? So like you can IM someone and ask them like, hey, I have this problem. Can you help me on this? Or like photos totally, like cutting photos for the blogs, the New York Times used to totally, totally suck as a reporter because you would have to do all of it yourself. And then, you know, by kind of complaining or just talking, you know, about it to developers, they're like, oh, that actually can be really solved simply. You know, like if it's always going to be 180 pixels, we can create something that can like cut it automatically and like, you know, enhance it and whatnot. So I'm a big proponent of basically creating social situations where people can just know each other personally. That's probably what I've seen a lot. Have you seen anything?
I mean, a simple thing that I actually did not do at the Post and only realized it at the very end is a lot of us use email to create kind of, you know, there's an all newsroom email. Mm-hmm. Almost never are any developers on it because they are on an all tech email. Right? So little things like that, kind of to think about it and kind of say, well, there's no reason why these 25, 30 people who spend most of their day jobs on newsroom issues are not part of this larger email, because these emails are used to celebrate things and, you know, inform people. Again, a little example of kind of creating collaboration is to kind of, they may still functionally have to be on an all IT email for some reason. No reason to not pick the 25 out of them and stick them in this email as well. So it's something that I've kind of, again, very at the tail end of my, we started doing at the Post, but it's worth doing.
And we talked about it earlier in terms of problems and solution, but to say it explicitly, early integration of cross-functional teams. So you have the initial idea, that first meeting where you sketch out the idea, you whiteboard it. Maybe traditionally in your organization, it's just the newsroom team. Get at least one developer in there just to bring ideas to the table and get them in on the ground floor.
And I think you might even see a more native culture with startups, right? So I'm helping, I have friends who are doing a new startup, and what you see actually is you have engineering, you have editorial, you have sort of business, and because they are actually all on the same email list, and like, you know, where there's serious issues that are discussed, but also like really funny issues, like, hey, have you seen this really funny cat video or whatever, you get a sense to know people's personalities, and so as a result, there's just better integration at that point, so that the people who are engineers actually sort of have opinions on editorial if they want to, and the people who are, you know, who work on product, for example, can also chip in on editorial, or editorial people can sometimes give a lot of, as users, have a lot of opinion on the product that's being sort of developed. So I think this is partially a legacy problem of legacy industries, and as things kind of grow natively from the web, you will see some of that early integration. Michael.
Hi, I'm Michael Scholar from Public Radio International. The suggestions you're making about letting people know each other socially, you know, bringing people in early in meetings, all are good. But I'm noticing almost a more fundamental problem, which has a little bit to do with different cultures colliding in different ways. So I find that hiring people outside of journalism who are into social media or into coding and the like, and bringing them into journalism, a lot of just the things that journalists worry about and think about don't make sense. For example, the clarity and the excitement of wording. So when it comes to developing a website, for example, you might have a social media person who's saying it's all about, you know, buttons and interaction and what you can do. You might have a journalist saying, you know, it's all about getting the big idea across of what we're trying to do. And then you might have a developer saying it's all about, you know, the elegance of the solution and, you know, and how simple the back end is. And, you know, and somewhere lost in all of that is the, you know, are really important elements, like, you know, photos, which don't quite fit into the social media realm, don't quite fit into the development realm, kind of fit into the journalism realm. And just, I don't know, have you had any experience? Because, you know, prior person mentioned, you know, contempt, but there are different worldviews that come at this, and you know, there, you know, people on the programming side, you know, often there's a, I got a list of tasks and I'm going to check them off. Journalists never think of what they're doing as a list of, or almost never, of a list of tasks. It's all about refining and kind of building. I'm going on and on, but more than just people, they're cultural mindsets. And often, you know, I find with younger employees, too, there's very much that there is a right way to do this. And when you have people with different right ways to do it, just any experiences, stories?
I mean, unless it's a startup, none of us have the luxury of starting with a new culture on day one and saying this is how it's going to be. So the tension between how it was and how it ought to be and how it might need to be are always going to collide. That's part of the reason I'm kind of desperately trying to recast the conversation to be more about the experience and about engagement. So then it's a very outward-in kind of a look, and it fits in with your example of, like, each one thinking about, you know, this is social or this is photos or this is words. If you're going to have a conversation with them about, well, what does this mean for the readers? Are we going to be able to kind of bring more of them to consume more of your content, our content? That may at least kind of get them to start thinking less about kind of the silos that we've always operated in and think more broadly. And the question needs to be asked up front, and it needs to be asked right from the top. And the good news about digital is that a lot of this is measurable, right? Unlike in print where we said, you know, it's tough to measure the experience because everybody assumes everybody's reading everything you write in print. The reality is not that, but digitally at least we can measure, and which then the importance of being able to show cause and effect and show the data and show kind of performance ties into reinforcing that message. There is no, at least I haven't found an easy kind of, you know, solution to this issue. The good news is as more and more hires are made, the people coming in seem to be less wedded to words or to kind of photos or to video, and more thinking in terms of, well, what does this all mean in terms of how can we put it together to create a good experience? So the balance is going to shift, but it's going to take a while. Right.
I can speak to this sort of in a sort of sideways way. So this is a completely different point, but it sort of has a similar solution. So I think it kind of depends very much on the mindset of the people that you hire. And so to give an example, I was helping my friends hire someone who has a business development role. And so originally they wanted someone who was very good at sales, right? So they wanted someone, because they saw the role in a very, very salesy world. And then at a certain point, they met all these salespeople, and they're like, oh, we don't like them as a class of people, right? Like, there's something interesting about the kind of personality of people that get drawn into sales. Like, they tend to be sort of very, like, competitive, sort of athletic kind of mindset. They're not necessarily, like, sort of mission-driven. Sometimes they are, but they are not. So they step back and define the role as someone who has experience fundraising, or, like, either for a profit or a campaign, and therefore has the ability to do sales in that they've convinced someone to do something, but has a mission-driven sort of perspective. So in that way, then you start sort of looking at people's resumes for the different light. Like, I'd rather have someone who has a journalistic mindset, who knows how to do social media, than someone to take. That's going to be much harder than taking someone who understands social media and then trying to get them into a journalism mindset. Did you just write something? Yes. And so that's what I would say. Like, can you hire people who are by temperament journalists? Right, and then they know how to code. Like, you know, they might not be the best coders. That will be a sacrifice that you will make. But because they care so much, they will learn and they will be passionate and they will do their jobs well. Because it takes three things for someone to do a job well, which is discipline, talent, and drive, passion, those three. So, I mean, it's always sort of a combination of give and take. But that's kind of what my thinking would be on that. Like, can I take someone and grow them? I mean, unfortunately, you know, you get a headcount that you inherit in some cases, so you don't have that luxury, but that's what I would say.
That's really helpful.
Yeah. Oh, good. Yay. And it's a good thing I'm on your advisory panel thing, or whatever.
Hi, I'm Tasneem Raja. I'm the digital interactive editor at Mother Jones. I don't really know what that title means, so I'm glad you guys brought up that point. Sometimes when I daydream about, like, what I would like my current newsroom to look like in 5 years, mm-hmm. I try to imagine a scenario in which there was no tech team and there was no editorial team, but we were just all sort of working side by side all the time. But I do, you know, I do then start to see some problems with that scenario, such as we do need people to work on the CMS. We do need people to, you know, fix some of the less glamorous storytelling buttons. Does reporting structure matter? So I've worked on as a web producer on a tech team, and now I work as an editorial producer who works alongside developers on an editorial team, and both of those have pluses and minuses. Does who you report to matter? Does reporting structure matter? Or should we be blowing up these lines? And just one more thing, I really hope you guys will make these slides shareable, because I'd like to just print these out and put them on a wall.
My keynote thanks you. And I do have a PDF that I can forward to. Can you can speak to that, because it's very interesting where you've gone.
Yes, so at my current job, my position started out reporting to the CTO, and then after a few months, we decided to move my team over to editorial, and I now report to the executive editor, and that change was something that we talked a lot about, but ended up being really good just because of the way things work at my current news organization. But I think it's at the Times, it was a little different. I know a lot of the newsroom developers actually reported up to the tech structure, similar to what Ruju described at the Washington Post, but then were effectively part of the newsroom through geography and through the projects that they worked on.
Yeah. And, I mean, yes, it totally does matter. And it's interesting to see newsroom, this is like a total side point, the sort of emergence of the product manager inside a newsroom culture is also very alien, because it's obviously very important in just the future going forward, but that's just an alien kind of title that's coming through
newsrooms and necessary right now. But yeah, essentially, of course, organizational structure matters, and who you report to matters, and the symbolism of what, you know, where you sit sort of matters. And I am actually totally happy to speak to you about it in detail after, since we are probably we're over time. But one of the things I want to say is if anyone wants any of these the PowerPoint as a PDF, like come up and you can give me your email and I'll email them to you. And I'll also probably put it on SlideShare, yeah, as well. So that would be
the internet.
Yeah, that's it. So thank you very much for coming. If you have any questions, we're going to be here for a couple minutes. And you know, if you have any kind of solution to what we should call the vocabulary of these new roles, we welcome all of that. Thank you very much.